You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Throughout history, new technology has always provided some challenges and some opportunities. There have been new devices that make some jobs a little bit obsolete, and in other cases, they redefine what people's jobs could be. Imagine being a painter in the 19th century. You spent most of your life training, practicing, developing your craft so that you could capture what important people, places, and things looked like. Until one day, a camera is developed and people say, "Hey, you know that picture it took you months to make? Well, this box can do the same thing in a matter of minutes." Now, some people would look at a setback like that and say, "Painting is done." But other people looked at it as an opportunity. And that's where artists like Claude Monet disregarded the old formal rules and structure of the academy, and they shifted the emphasis towards color. They changed the compositional style. They started to make things a little bit looser, even abstract. And in doing so, they completely shifted people's ideas of what art is and what art could be.
I feel like who Art Ed.
Let's try to spice it.
Mr. Wood, Art Ed me.
Yeah. Either way, it's ambiguous. It works on so many levels.
I know.
That's a great start. Welcome to Who Arted, where we explore visual arts in an audio medium. I'm your host, Kyle Wood, and joining me today is Courtney Sindlar, the art teacher at Napier Elementary. Thanks for joining me.
Yeah.
So today we're talking about Claude Monet, and Claude Monet was like one of the first artists I remember learning about. I remember like a parent coming in, one of those art appreciation lessons when I was in like second grade, and I was captivated. It was first artist that captured my imagination. What about you? Like, do you have any, like, do you like his work? Familiar with the, you know?
That's why I picked him.
Yeah.
Because when I was in elementary school, we didn't have art class. And so my third grade teacher would do art projects with us like once a month or so. Yeah. And one of them was painting Monet's lily pads. And it just like, I just loved it. Like you're saying, like, it just is one of those things you look at and you're like, wow, that is so cool.
Yeah, it is. But I always like to start with a little bit of context. And with Monet, I think about the world of 200 years ago was so different. I mean, not exactly 200 years ago. He was born in 1840. But when I think about like the 19th century, that was kind of like the Industrial Revolution. And most people think of like the Industrial Revolution and mechanization and how that impacted lots of different things. But in the arts, there were a lot of innovations that I think explain why some of these shifts happened.
Mm-hmm.
So like, for example, Monet, born in 1840, that was just a year after Daguerre sort of released his photographic process. And I say like released the photographic process to the public because he didn't like patent it. I believe like the French government gave him like a lifetime pension in exchange for just making that knowledge open source. And so like photography was booming in the late 19th, early 20th century. And I got to think like, if I'm a painter at that time when the camera comes around,
mm-hmm.
I'm looking at my competition and I'm thinking, what can I do that the camera can't?
Yeah.
You know? And so like color was obviously a big deal then. Color photography was not a thing, but painters were working with color.
Mm-hmm.
And like, that's where I see, like, the Impressionism was a product of that time in so many ways, you know, the shift towards the emphasis on color.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I thought was really interesting is, and this is something I don't, like, most people don't think of, but the invention of the tube of paint. Like, we don't think about that as something that had to be invented, because for us, that's just always been there.
Mm-hmm.
But before then, like, artists, they were gathering and grinding raw materials to make paint. And mm-hmm. and then they were storing it in, like, glass or, popularly for a long time, a pig's bladder. Which, if you get over, like, the ick factor, that's just also super inconvenient. You know what I mean? And so, like, mm-hmm. Monet and the other Impressionists, they're painting outdoors in plain air, as they would say. And, like, you couldn't do that without the tube of paint.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I also just, like, as the nerd in me is always, like, when I start to go down that rabbit hole of, like, you know, the tube of paint, like, I always think Impressionists and that focus on color, to some extent, it was just like a kid playing with the new materials. Because, like, you look at the blue of water lilies, and it's this mm-hmm. gorgeous combination. I see, like, some ultramarine, some Prussian blue, some cerulean in there. Like, I see all those different colors out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of that's just because it became suddenly cheap and easy to get those things. For most of history, you couldn't. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like blue. Blue has a ridiculous history. I got to do, like, an episode on just the history of blue, but, like, up until, like, the 1820s, you know, it was all about ultramarine. It was 1826. They put out, like, a prize of, like, 6,000 francs for anyone who could make a synthetic ultramarine, because, like, lapis lazuli stones that they were using to make blue, like, ultramarine blue pigment was more valuable than gold. Because it would take mm-hmm. like a kilogram, 1,000 grams to make 30 grams of pigment. That's nuts.
Wow.
Yeah, it's like super labor intensive.
Oh yeah. I didn't know that blue had that much go in, like, into the history of getting different colors.
Well, because, like, if you think about, they were gathering their pigments from raw materials, right?
Yeah.
Well, how many raw materials are blue? What's blue? Water, the sky, but those things aren't inherently blue like dirt is brown. It's just the way that light scatters through those things.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? There's not, like, a blue shell around the earth, just like the only way they could get blue is the lapis lazuli stones that for a long time were only mined in, like, one region in Afghanistan. So it was, like, super labor intensive to get it. Anyways, that, like I said, that's just the nerd in me, just, like, this is so cool that they were able to do that stuff. But again, at that time, that was new technology. And just like I play with my iPad, I think a lot of painters were just like, oh, I've got all these colors suddenly available to me. Yeah, I'm going to use them all. But, like, back to Monet specifically, like, those were the innovations in his lifetime. Those were the new technology that were taking root in his lifetime. And as a child and a teen, like, he earned money making caricatures and portraits of people. Like, he showed that promise and that skill from an early age. But it was kind of like I always think of him, like, doing those caricatures. It's kind of like he was like a Banksy type of person where, like, people on the streets appreciated his work, but the Fine Art Academy was not so welcoming of him. The establishment, actually, he was rejected from exhibitions for a long time. Like, his career early on, he suffered. He became depressed because, like, he was not getting the success that he would have liked in the art world. And, you know, it was kind of a mutual thing because he also hated art school and being assigned to do copies of famous works and the traditional, like, Greek and Roman subjects, because, you know, in that time, like, after the Baroque era and stuff, it's like everything needs to be so big and grand and formal, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the Impressionists, and this is one of those things that, like, it's such a simple idea. It's so easy to forget how kind of revolutionary it was. But they decided to paint, like, the ordinary, everyday people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the landscapes and stuff that seemed to be beneath painters. Because the fine artists, they were thinking of, like, we're painting royalty. We're painting important historical mm-hmm. figures and battles and epic significance. And so, like, Monet was just going totally against that. And so he was one of a collection of artists that started to put together, like, a group show of their different new revolutionary approach to painting that was supposed to be sort of apolitical and just, like, all about painting beautiful pictures, landscapes, ordinary people, and stuff like that. And in 1874, they put together that group exhibition. And this is actually where the term Impressionism comes from. The Impressionist movement was named for Monet's painting. Did you know that?
I did not know that it was specifically from him, no.
Yeah, Impression Sunrise. In that exhibition, 1874, before that, they were just calling themselves, like, Society of Independent... No, it wasn't Society of Independent Artists. It was something along those lines, you know? And they were putting together an independent art show, and a critic hated the work, and specifically Monet's Impression Sunrise. And so he titled his review, The Exhibition of the Impressionists, and, you know, an impression being kind of a rough sketch, and mm-hmm. derisively saying, like, these aren't finished paintings, these aren't ready for display, these are just impressions. Because of the mm-hmm. sloppy brushstrokes. That's one of those things that, like, my students, I don't know about your students, but my students, like, always look at it and they think, like, it's so realistic. It's so beautiful. But at that time, it was, like, scandalously sloppy.
Yeah.
You know, to show all the brushstrokes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so the Impressionists, they ran with that. You know, they just took on that label, and, you know, it's kind of reclaiming the term, you know, not just, like, hiding from the derisive term, but embracing it and redefining it. And so that became the name for their movement that really became one of the most popular out there. Like, it's, you know, people love the Impressionists. Mm. Of course, Monet was... I don't know if you... Did you ever watch the show Seinfeld?
Not really.
Okay. So there's this one episode where one of the characters is talking about how he thinks that Monet was nearsighted because there's no other reason you would paint things so messy. And people actually joked about that in his day. But he really did have vision problems. And it really did affect the way he painted. He had cataracts and... he was mocked for his paintings looking so blurry because of this vision problems. Like, today we would talk about that as, like, discriminating against a person with a disability, but he was very distraught over that. And so he underwent some surgery in, like, 1923. To correct the cataracts. And I guess it left him with, he perceived color differently. And so he wore tinted glasses after that to correct for that vision. But some people say he actually might have been able to see ultraviolet light, which I think is kind of an interesting thing after that, which, like, would explain, if you look at his collection of work, after that point, the colors do shift a little bit. There's a difference in the way he's applying it. And, you know, famously, he made a series of water lilies. We're going to look at water lilies in a bit, but I just want to take a moment to point out, like, I always loved this idea that he kept painting for his whole life. He loved that garden, and that garden, like, he, after he became successful, he didn't rest on his laurels. He kept painting. He made, like, 250 paintings of the water lilies in that garden. And he hired gardeners to bring in plants from all over the world. Like, the water lilies were from Egypt and South America. And he even hired someone just to go out on a boat in the morning and dust the lily pads before he would go out and paint them. Like, that's just kind of the dedication that he had to that garden. which I find, you know, it's not my thing, but, you know, to each his or her own. I just love the fact that, like, he was that dedicated to his craft and continued with it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Have you ever wondered who the Mary was from Bloody Mary? If the Loch Ness Monster was real, or if Ouija boards actually worked? On each episode of the family-friendly Unspookable, we look at the histories and mysteries behind your favorite scary stories, myths, and urban legends to get the real stories behind the scares. Want to solve your next mystery? Find and follow Unspookable now wherever you get your podcasts.
So now we're going to shift towards looking at one of his most famous paintings, Water Lilies. And this is, as I said, he did like 250 of them. This is Water Lilies from 1906. This is the one that I see on display at the Art Institute of Chicago, when I had a poster of in my bedroom growing up. As you look at it, what jumps out at you?
For me, it's the colors. I just think, the blue that you have that contrasts then with the greens, you have a nice analogous palette going on. And then you've got little specks of some purples and some pinks that come in. I just think the subtlety between the different elements is really, to me, what draws me to his, all of his work, but this one in particular.
Yeah. I mean, and looking at this pond, the color scheme definitely caught my eye. That was one of the first things that caught my eye, even as a kid. There's something about that combination of, it's like a cerulean with a Prussian blue that just, mm-hmm. I just always find that combination just gorgeous and soothing. And it's this tranquil water. As I look at this more and more, I find it really interesting the way that the lily pads are floating on that water. We don't see any horizon line. We don't see any ground. There is in some ways like a reflection of maybe trees and bushes on the water. And so then the blue of the water becomes a sky. But it's this interesting sort of like figure ground play where it's like, I know these are water lilies and I know they're floating on a pond, but they're also floating compositionally. You know what I mean? Like they're in that sense of like that abstract things go. And to me, that's really interesting, is the way it's 1 foot in the representational column and 1 foot in the abstract column. You know?
Yeah.
Like, and I start to look at this and I think, you know, this was 1906. This was at that time when you know, Kandinsky and Picasso and others were really pushing the boundaries of, you know, what abstract art could be.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like this was in some ways his way of saying, like, yeah, I'm still there with you guys. Still keeping up with the new trends a little bit, getting, you know, like I said, because of the way that it's tightly cropped on the water. Like, I think he's still doing what he loves, but I think he's still a little bit keeping up with the trend towards greater and greater abstraction. Or at least that's how I see it.
No, I definitely see that. I've never really looked at it that way, so it's interesting to look at it from that perspective. But it does have that sense of, like, once you start thinking about it, are they floating like in front of something, or are they on the water? Like, you can see the difference of how you can, like, just shifting your perspective on what you're looking at shifts the entire composition of the painting. interesting.
Yeah, it's one of those ones that I really like his water lilies much more than most of the rest of his body of work. What I find really interesting is Claude Monet was the first artist I loved as a child and then hated as an art student. And now I'm coming back around.
Really? Why did you start hating him?
Haystacks. Just looking at haystack after haystack. It's one of those things that, so like to show my biases here, I love modernism. I'm very much a modern guy. I grew up in like looking at the and a lot of the Western canon, you know, traditionally, but I like things that are conceptual. I'm drawn to a lot of that sort of stuff. And I started to find Monet to be unsatisfying as I got older and started to look at, it's all about optics, you know, it's all about how we perceive color. And I think that largely was just due to my shallow read of what he was doing. As I've grown up and I've matured, I think he was doing more than I appreciated, and like my not picking up on that was my failing, not his, you know? But I think some of his work, I feel like, really just missed the mark for me. But some of it, like especially like the water lilies, I really, really enjoy, because it creates this nice mood. There are the expressive qualities to it. But also, like I say, he's playing with things and doing things that are, I think, really interesting. There's a little bit of figure ground play, and there's a little bit of, like I said, the tension between the realism and the abstraction, and trying to synthesize these different approaches that are in some ways like antithetical or like opposites. They don't fit together nicely for younger listeners. But I do find this to be a really nice piece. And the other thing I'm noticing, like as I look at this, as much as there's no horizon, essentially, you know, there's still a sense of depth. Like we still see those distant lily pads and things like that, that it's hard to say they're less in focus, because all of this is a blur of brush strokes in some ways, or maybe that's just because I broke my glasses. So I'm right there with Monet on the nearsighted right now. But like we do see a slight allusion towards linear perspective, because as you look towards the top, those lily pads, the ellipse is getting pinched and flattened. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so again, it's one of those things where it's like, this stuff doesn't happen by accident. He's clearly aware of and has internalized all of these different skills and all these different strategies. And he's laying them out there in a way that I find interesting, because it breaks so many rules while still showing that he understands and has mastered those rules.
Mm-hmm. Well, it does allude to a vanishing point. If you look at the way the lines that are drawn by some of the connections of some of the lily pads, it does give you that sense of perspective that things are traveling back to a point.
Yeah.
Like it would. Yeah.
Yeah. Like I say, he's nodding towards that.
Yeah.
The traditional perspective. And like I said, there is a little bit of depth to it, but it's not in the way that you would learn in the academy, like step by step, like, okay, we're going to, vanishing points here, guidelines are going here, you know, parallel connecting lines and all that sort of stuff. It's all very free flowing and organic, and he does it in a way that feels effortless.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like he's doing it by just pure instinct, but you don't do that so consistently across your body of work by pure instinct.
Mm-mm.
You know,
That's what I enjoy about the impressionists when I talk to them, talk to students about them, that they do have this feeling in their artwork that it's more about how the artist views the world and then puts what they're seeing on the canvas instead of making it hyper realistic and how, you know, how it should be and the expectations of what was the right way to paint and the wrong way to paint. I find that about the impressionists to be very interesting.
Yeah. It's, what's the Italian term, like sprezzatura, for that, like studied carelessness? We always got to use big words so that as we're talking about our laziness, it sounds really purposeful.
Sounds better. This is what I don't know.
But like, there is something about that where the impressionists in general, and I think Monet specifically, it looks like it's just like dashed off. It looks like a quick sketch. It looks like, you know, like a momentary impression. Like he's just like, okay, here it is. And it just plopped out on the canvas that way. But, you know, he made 250 of these. He was studying, he was practicing. And it's like, there's a lot more work that goes into it than I think is evident in the canvas, but the canvas comes out looking relaxed, looking easy. And that's soothing and pleasant for me to look at. You know what I mean? Like, it just feels calm. It feels relaxed. It feels like he's having fun. Although he's also very carefully working at it.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else you want to say about this one?
No, I think I'm good.
I think we covered it. Right. And I'm wrapping it up. I want just a 3-point rating scale. And where should this hang? The Louvre? Is this something to look at? The lab? Is this something to learn from? Or the loop, British for bastard.
Yeah,
there's the loop joke in there somewhere.
Oh, that's terrible.
I don't know. I'm torn. I definitely think I love it. I think it's beautiful. It belongs in the Louvre. But I do think there's a lot we can learn from Monet, especially the color palettes, how he chose colors, how he used colors, his brush strokes. So I'm torn between the two. Can I pick both?
Yeah, people break the rules all the time. I'm not a strict guy, in case you haven't noticed.
Okay.
You can ask me anything, and I'm just like, sure, whatever. Sure. That sounds good. I share that tension. As I was thinking about this, I landed on, for this specific piece, I feel like this is a museum piece because I feel like this is elevated because of, like I said, that cropped composition that I feel like is interesting because he retains all the expressive qualities through his brushstrokes, through the, you know, deceptively simple composition. It feels relaxed, it feels calm, it feels soothing, but he's doing all these other things that are alluding to a little bit of figure ground play, a little bit of linear perspective, and all of that I think elevates it and makes it something I can learn from and enjoy looking at, which to me, that's what a good museum piece is all about. His body of work in general, I feel like, is more suited towards the lab, where, like I said, you look at how many haystacks did he paint in every different time of day, every time of day and every different season. And it's like Joseph Albers. It feels like it is this methodical study that we can learn from, but, oh man, wake me up when it's over, you know? So that's where I land on that.
Well,
any other finals?
Sounds good to me. No, I think I'm good.
Oh, thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it. Good talking about Monet. Good to talk to you too, like get to know you a little bit more.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me.
This concludes this week's episode of Who Arted, part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. If you found this tolerable, please leave a rating or review on your favorite podcast app. You can find images of the work being discussed this week and every week on social media at Who Arted Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok, and of course on the website whoartedpodcast.com. Podcast done.